Mr. Rolfe.
May it please the Court, my name is James Rolfes and I'm here today on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Samuel Morgan. This case is before this Court today because the District Court wrongly believed its hands were tied by the federal habeas statute. Time and again, the District Court, in considering Mr. Morgan's petition, determined that the Illinois Supreme Court based its decisions regarding Morgan's constitutionally protected rights on either a misapplication of Supreme Court precedent or an objectively unreasonable determination of fact. In particular, the District Court found and held that photographic evidence flatly contradicted the Illinois Supreme Court's factual determinations regarding a key recantation witness, found significant evidence of intoxication where the Illinois court said there was none, identified persuasive credibility arguments on behalf of Mr. Morgan where the Illinois court failed to reconcile those determinations with its unsupported credibility findings, and concluded that the Illinois Supreme Court had conducted a mystifying Brady analysis that employed circular and nonsensical logic. In doing so, the District Court recognized multiple constitutional errors that prejudiced Morgan's guilt trial. Even so, the Court gave deference to the determination of the Illinois Court, abdicating its judicial review responsibility and eviscerating Mr. Morgan's federal habeas rights. In doing so, the District Court committed reversible error. Your Honors, under the federal habeas statute, a petitioner is entitled to habeas relief if he shows by clear and convincing evidence the state court determination of a constitutional claim is either contrary to or an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent or is based on an objectively unreasonable determination of fact. Decisions that are based on incorrect factual determinations are objectively unreasonable. Further, courts have held that failure to reconcile key parts of the record that undermine the state court's determinations also can provide a basis for an unreasonable determination of fact. Here, the District Court found both things, but still gave deference to what the state court did. Deference, however, Your Honors, is not a preclusion of relief. There has to be some relief that's available to a petitioner that presents what Mr. Morgan did here. Let's first look at the recantation at the heart of many of Morgan's constitutional claims. As the record reflects, Elijah Plater testified at the original trial back in the early 80s that Morgan committed two homicides. On post-conviction hearing, Mr. Prater recanted that testimony, saying that one of the victims actually killed the other victim and then was killed himself by Mr. Morgan, who acted in self-defense and the defense of others. The evidence that was before the Illinois Supreme Court and the Illinois lower court was clear and convincing that the recantation evidence that was presented was supported by clear and convincing evidence, whereas the evidence that was in the original trial was directly contradicted by it. What do we have? We've presented to this court and we presented to all the courts before the photographic evidence that was presented in the post-conviction proceeding. That photographic evidence was consistent with what was the recantation evidence was and was flatly contradicted, said the district court, what was done back in the trial. At trial, Prater testified that the victim, Motley, was shot while sitting on a love seat in the living room. When you look at the photographs, there is absolutely no blood anywhere on the love seat, no blood anywhere around the love seat. This was presented to the Illinois court, which tried to reconcile that since that flatly contradicted his trial testimony. The Illinois Supreme Court tried to reconcile it by looking to one piece of the evidence of testimony given by Phyllis Gregson, another eyewitness to the claim. Phyllis Gregson said that the body, when shot, flew off the couch, which the Supreme Court said, well, that's the explanation for it. There's nothing on the couch. The body must have flown 6 or 7 feet across the room. Well, there's two problems with that reconciliation. One is, if you look at the actual testimony of Phyllis Gregson, she said it flew to right next to the couch. In other words, it fell right next to the position on the couch. Therefore, the photographic evidence still contradicts her testimony because there was no blood anywhere around the couch in the photographs. Secondarily, the Illinois Supreme Court said that the two eyewitnesses said that there was an attempt to clean up the blood after the victim was shot. But when we again look at the photographs, you see the evidence of where they tried to clean up the blood, and it's smeared, and it's they tried to use towels, according to the testimony, to try to clean up the blood. And there was no way that these people, in the time that they had, plus they were drinking alcohol and taking massive bloods, could have so cleaned up that area of the couch that when the police came with 2 hours later and took photographs of the apartment, they wouldn't have noted the blood on or around the couch where the person was shot. Lastly, in order for that body to fly the 5 or 6 feet to where it ended up in the photographs, it would have had to go in the opposite direction in which the testimony at trial said it was shot. In other words,
the cleaning up process, is it possible somebody moved the couch?
Your Honor, at trial, actually, Elijah Prater testified that when he looked at the photographs that were put there, he said that was the location of the couch at the time of the murders.
Which witness is that?
Elijah Prater is the witness that recanted his testimony in the post-conviction proceeding.
Did he say that in the first trial or the second?
He said that in the first trial.
The problem I have with this whole argument, counsel, is that in cases like this where there's all kinds of contradictory evidence, it's the job of the state courts to sort that out. And they did so here, including the weight, if any, that the recantation deserved. And we just don't second-guess those kinds of credibilities and weight of the evidence and reconcile conflicting evidence kinds of questions on habeas review unless it can meet the extremely high standard for unreasonable fact-finding. And in this case just doesn't. There's all kinds of conflicting facts, as there often will be in cases like this. And recantations are viewed with great suspicion, particularly under the circumstances here where there is physical evidence and disinterested and interested eyewitness testimony and disinterested eyewitness testimony in the witness who was in the apartment below who didn't see what was going on but heard what was going on, and then the witness at the motel where the female victim of the rape and kidnapping was taken by your client immediately after the murders. So, you know, when you've got a case like this, you're going to have a real problem on federal habeas review getting us to say that the state courts engaged in unreasonable factual determination.
Well, and I understand where the court is coming from there, Your Honor, but I would respectfully submit that we have met that high standard that does apply to the federal habeas here. First of all, you have to look at what the district court found and the findings that he found with regard to the physical evidence. He said it flatly contradicted.
That's okay.
That's pretty strong.
That's very strong. He
strong
said that,
language.
But, you know, he said he would have decided it differently, but that's not the standard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would have given more weight to that contradiction than did the state courts, but it's the state court's prerogative to decide how much weight to give that kind of contradiction, even a flat contradiction.
But it is the federal court's responsibility under the federal habeas statute to look to determine if the state court determinations are based on an unreasonable determination of fact. And here, if the district court finds that it's flatly contradicted by the physical evidence, that gets very, I think that meets that particular type of standard. I think also if we look at the credibility issue, or if we look at the downstairs neighbor, when we look at his testimony is not, as the state tries to say that it is, that he heard these shots at the time of when the trial was put there versus what was with the recantation. He said he heard shatterings. He didn't hear shots until the very end, which is consistent, again, with the recantation evidence, not necessarily with the trial testimony. Plus, the downstairs neighbor said he heard the shattering at a time when Prater at trial said that he was asleep. So when you look at all the evidence and you try to reconcile it with what the recantation evidence said and what the court and what was said at the trial court, what was done at the trial court is, first of all, contradicted by the physical evidence, and plus doesn't make sense in so many different ways. I mean, how do you deal with the fact that Prater, who just supposedly witnesses this brutal unexplainable murder, leaves the apartment, and then comes back 15 minutes later when he's not even part of the particular crime. The way it's explained is on the recantation, right? So in which he says, you know, that Motley killed Merkson and then tried to kill both Morgan and Prater. Then it makes sense that Prater comes back. So, Your Honor, I think that this is a case in which when you look at every single thing that the Illinois courts did, we've presented in the record why what they did was based on an unreasonable determination of fact. Moving on, I think we have another issue in this case, which is the Brady violation. Here we have evidence in the record in which Phyllis Gregson, the other eyewitness, had been arrested and had her three drug charges nulli proster, not prosecuted, by the state courts at the very time that she was testifying in this case. That particular information was asked for by the defense, and it was not turned over at the time. If you look at what the district court did when it looked at what the Illinois state court's decision was, is it found specifically what the habeas statute says is a basis for relief. It found that the Illinois courts had issued an opinion that was contrary to or based on an unreasonable application of existing Supreme Court precedent. Clearly, it's Brady material. The district court found that it was uncontroversial. It also found that this was the type of material that is typically needed to be turned over. And
the district court also said there's no possibility it could have affected the outcome, and therefore there was no Brady violation. So the district court agreed with the state court.
Well, I think if you read the district court's opinion, first of all, it doesn't apply the right Brady standard either. If you read the district court's opinion, it thought that what it had to do was determine whether for the materiality test under Brady was to determine that the evidence would have changed the conviction. That's clearly not the standard for a Brady violation, which is you need to show that there's a reasonable belief that the outcome would have been different. Here, we never had a materiality.
The district court said there was no possibility, and no possibility is inconsistent with a reasonable possibility that it would have changed the outcome. That's why I said the district court found there was no Brady violation. So I don't see how you think the district court is at odds with the state court, which reached the same conclusion. They might have used different reasoning, but they have the same bottom line.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think what the district court did when it came especially to the evidence with regards to the rape charge is that it went through all the reasons why this particular evidence could have had a real impact on the credibility of that particular testimony, and what it came down to in the end was applied the same circular reasoning that it said discredited the Illinois Supreme Court's case, and then said there's no basis to undo the reasonable finding of the state court, in which the state court never came to a conclusion on the materiality. There was never materiality at the state court level. The Illinois Supreme Court never did an appropriate materiality test under Brady, and
the court said that the information should have been turned over, but didn't make a difference. I thought, isn't that basically the same thing?
It said it didn't make a difference, but in doing so, did it look at for the murder charges the Gregson testimony was flatly contradicted by the physical evidence as well, and the only reason it gave about the murder charges was that the Prater testimony was there. And on number two, on the rape charges, what it says, it really came down to the basis of materiality, which we put out there as an intoxication defense, which it went to the Supreme Court again, but the Supreme Court, of course, didn't look to the fact that there were affidavits in the record that the Illinois Supreme Court ignored regarding the ability of Mr. Morgan to form the intent at the time of the crimes. Your Honors, I see my time is up for this point.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you. Ms. Wong.
Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Sherry Wong, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General here on behalf of the Respondent Warden. With respect to Prater's recantation, as this Court noted, a state court's factual determination is not unreasonable merely because the federal habeas court would have reached a different conclusion in the first instance. Now here, although petitioner points to evidence that would tend to undermine Prater's original trial testimony and would support Prater's recantation, there's just as much evidence, if not more, that tends to undermine the credibility of that recantation. And where there is a reasonable basis in the state court record for the Illinois Supreme Court to have credited Prater's original trial testimony and discredited his recantation, petitioner is not entitled to habeas relief. Now, as Your Honors noted, there was a reasonable basis because, first, there was the testimony of Frank Bloom, who was an independent witness. And he testified at trial that he heard loud noises around 11, 12, and 1 o'clock. And those loud noises corroborated Prater's original trial testimony that petitioner shot Motley around 11, shot Merkson at 12, and then shot at Prater at 1:15. Now, although petitioner argues that Bloom testified variously regarding the sound of the shots, whether or not they were shattering shots or blasting shots, specifically on page 502 of Exhibit PP in the state court record, Bloom characterizes all the shots as blasting sounds. And he testified, which is clear throughout his testimony, that all the sounds sounded similar. So I think the takeaway from his testimony is that he heard loud noises which could reasonably be interpreted as shots around 11, 12, and 1, which corroborates both Prater and Gregson's trial testimony and is directly inconsistent with Prater's recantation testimony, which, according to Prater, happened much closer in time. Prater testified that Motley shot Merkson, and then 30 seconds later, petitioner shot Motley, and that stands in direct contrast to Bloom's testimony. In addition, there's also Prater's testimony, which was corroborated by Gregson's trial testimony. And Gregson, up until now, has, even though she passed away in 1995, she never recanted her trial testimony. Her testimony, as Your Honor noted, was corroborated by independent evidence at the trial. There was a motel engineer who testified that he saw petitioner point a gun at Gregson's head. Petitioner then pointed the gun at him, chased him, and then the engineer saw petitioner push Gregson headfirst into the car. This independent evidence corroborates Gregson's testimony regarding the rape and aggravated kidnapping, and that evidence tends to bolster the credibility of her trial testimony regarding Morgan's murders of Motley and Merkson. In addition to both of those independent, that independent evidence, there was also the independent evidence of the state court's specific credibility finding regarding Prater's recantation. Following a three-day evidentiary hearing, the state post-conviction trial court had made a specific credibility finding that Prater's recantation was simply not credible. This was based on the fact that Prater, on three prior occasions before his evidentiary hearing testimony, testified at the 1982 grand jury testimony, at the 1983 trial, and specifically at in his 1995 affidavit. His account of the murders were consistent with his trial testimony. And I think that 1995 affidavit is particularly important because in that affidavit, Prater explicitly, maybe not explicitly, but at least implicitly affirms his trial testimony. At that time, he's had the opportunity, he's giving testimony that would be favorable to the petitioner. But at that time, he does not come forward with his recantation testimony. Prater still gives an affidavit that is perfectly consistent with his trial testimony and does not bring up the fact that petitioner shot Motley in self-defense and did not even shoot Merkson. So that's another independent basis on which the state court could conclude that Prater's recantation was not credible. Now, with respect to this photographic evidence, petitioner's assumptions about the photographic evidence depends on a theory of forensic science that simply was not supported by any forensic science in state court. And where there was no evidence in state court to prove that it was physically impossible for Motley's body to go forward in the direction of the shot rather than backwards into the couch, the state court could not have been unreasonable in rejecting Prater's version of the events. We're not arguing that petitioner was required to present forensic evidence or expert testimony in state court to prove up his state law actual innocence claim. What we're merely saying is that where petitioner did not present the forensic evidence to prove that it is physically impossible for Prater's original trial testimony to not be true, then it was not unreasonable for the state court to not credit that version of events.
I assume this issue was argued at the jury trial, the inconsistency between the physical evidence as photographed by the responding law enforcement officers and the trial testimony of the witnesses?
That was not brought out at trial.
Okay, so this was not discussed at trial?
No.
Blood on the couch issue?
That's correct. The photographic evidence, the crime scene photos, were introduced at trial, but this argument about whether or not the forensic evidence was contradictory to the trial testimony was not discussed at trial. The first time that came up was at the 2001 post-conviction evidentiary hearing.
That's really interesting. I mean, it seems to me it's a fairly obvious line of attack.
Petitioner's not arguing here that counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this argument. And as petitioner is claiming here that it's so obvious that this forensic evidence is so, you know, inconsistent with the trial testimony, but no one thought to bring that up at trial. So the fact that maybe it's not that obvious. And in fact...
Well, there either was or wasn't blood on the couch.
That's true. And
pictures say no.
Right? We would agree that the pictures demonstrate that there is no blood on the couch, but...
The body was found? It was moved, so that's a problem.
It was moved. There was evidence that indicated that the body had been wrapped in a mattress, and that was where it was found.
Right.
But there
was an effort to clean up the scene, so...
Exactly.
And all that was argued to the jury, I assume.
The evidence regarding the Prater and Gregson's attempt to clean up the scene, that was brought up at the first trial, yes.
Right.
But there, going back to the lack of blood evidence on the couch, there are reasonable explanations for why there would be no blood evidence on the couch and for how Prater's original trial testimony could be true. It's possible that Motley was on the edge of the couch. It's possible he was leaning forward, trying to get away from the petitioner when he saw petitioner bringing out the shotgun. It's possible that based on the type of shotgun and the type of shotgun pellets that were used, the force of the blast could have caused Motley to go forward as opposed to backward. The medical examiner testified that there were exit wounds on Motley's body. That could explain the lack of blood evidence on the couch and the lack of blood spatter on the walls. Given these reasonable explanations, it's possible that Motley still could have been shot on the love seat and instead fell forward rather than going backwards. And given the fact that there is that explanation in the state court record, petitioner cannot demonstrate that the Illinois Supreme Court was unreasonable in rejecting Prater's recantation, particularly given the other evidence that supported that Prater's recantation was not reliable. Again, the post-conviction trial court made a specific credibility finding that Prater's reasons for coming forward were not credible and that his claim of coercion was simply vague and also not credible. So given those findings, the Illinois Supreme Court was not unreasonable in rejecting the recantation. There had been a question about Prater's illogical behavior after the murders, and I think the record indicates Detective Whalen testified that Prater and Gregson had been seeing each other, and that it was possible that because Gregson and Prater had been seeing each other, Prater returned back to the house after petitioner had shot Motley and Merson because he was afraid for Gregson. So that explains the otherwise illogical behavior. And because there is that explanation in the record, the Illinois Supreme Court could not have been unreasonable in rejecting that, in rejecting Prater's recantation. Now, with respect to the Brady violation, petitioner has pointed to no evidence in the record that there was any leniency agreement that was in place between the state for Gregson to testify against petitioner in exchange for favorable treatment on those drug arrests. Now, we fully agree that the state should have disclosed that April 1982 drug arrest and the full dispositions of both of those drug arrests, but the record does not disclose that there was a deal in place. And, in fact, the record indicates that there was no deal that was made, and the procedural history of this case demonstrates that. On January 30th, 1982, Gregson gave her statement to police implicating the petitioner in the murders and aggravated kidnapping. And then In April of 1982, she's arrested for those drug charges and then is arrested in May of 1982 for those drug charges. So there's no deal that could have been made when Gregson originally gave her statement to police in January of 1982 because she had not been arrested for those drug charges yet. So any attempt to point to any deal simply fails, and any attempt to impeach Gregson's credibility on the basis of that deal also fails. Unless Your Honors have any questions on the ineffective assistance claims, we'll stand on our briefs. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Counsel. The case is taken under advisement.